Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Ronit Widman-Levy. It is my pleasure to introduce Seth M. Siegel, author of Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World. Seth is a graduate of Cornell University and Cornell Law School and studied international relations at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He began his career as an assistant district attorney in New York City before successfully founding several companies, including Beanstalk Group, which grew to be a global company, and he advised a number of Fortune 500 companies. Seth serves as board chair of the Cornell University Hillel, sits on the board of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Moderating tonight's conversation is Lisa Krieger, science, medicine, and water reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Seth M. Siegel and Lisa Krieger.
Thank you so much, kind introduction. So like California, Israel is in a very arid region. Also like California, its population's growing, its economy's growing, and it's a center for innovation. But unlike California, it's got a water surplus. It actually exports water to its neighbors, which is just remarkable. So there are a lot of lessons in Seth's book that I learned in reading it, which I really recommend. It's a fabulous book. And what it suggests, there's reason for optimism, that with enough investment and changed attitudes and time, that we can build a very stable water future, that there is a way forward. So what we'll do tonight is talk about a lot of what we share, some of the differences between our experiences, learn about these lessons. But I wanted to start the conversation by setting the stage a little bit with history. And Israel's a young nation. It started as a poor nation. And like a lot of developing nations, it didn't have a lot of resources. It certainly didn't have a lot of water. But what it did, unlike a lot of other developing nations, is it had the leadership and the vision and the public policy to move water to center stage. It made it critically important. And what I'd like to ask you, Seth, is how did it do that? Set the stage for us a little bit.
Thank you. I'm glad to answer that. By the way, if I just say before I answer your question, I want to say what a thrill it is for me to be here in front of both the Commonwealth Club and also the Oshman JCC. For many years now, I have been either watching on book shows on cable or else listening to podcasts of the Commonwealth Club, and I never imagined that I would be invited to come out and speak before this group. So it's a great thrill, and that it should be here at this venue, at a very important institution in a world that means a lot to me as well, and headed by a dear friend of mine, Zach Bodner, means quite a bit to me to be here. So I just want to say thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. It really fulfills, quite an emotional piece for me, and I'm really flattered that I was asked by two institutions that I care about. So the historical piece is actually an interesting one. And the question is, where do you start? And as a writer, in thinking about this, it's do I start the story in the 1930s? Do I start the story in the 1880s when the first of the new wave of Zionist settlers started coming from Europe and elsewhere? Or do I even start the story in antiquity? 2,700 years ago, for those of you who care to check this out later, Hezekiah, King Hezekiah, survived a siege by the Assyrians by coming up with a way to secure water from outside the city walls in the Gihon Spring. And so one could have started the story a long, long time ago, because actually in antiquity, it was the first time that they started thinking about securing their water and being able to keep it so that it would be impermeable from both the elements, from animals, and from people who would put siege to their cities. So it's really so the idea of water and water security, certainly in the Middle East, is quite an old story. For reasons of story compression, I end up starting the story in the 1930s. But it was I just wanted to point out, because we are having a conversation tonight, that it was actually a storyteller's challenge as to where to begin the story. And I start the story with a fascinating individual who I came to say that maybe this happens with some of you when you read a book or when you do research, is one of the several people in the course of the research of this book that I actually fell in love with. He was an interesting guy. In 1930, he immigrates from Poland. His name is Simcha Blas, and he is a graduate of the equivalent of the MIT of Poland when he arrives. He thinks he's going to be an inventor. He fails as an inventor. And within a year or two, he decides that what he really needs to do, he's looking around, is that the future of the Zionist enterprise, he says, will be tied to the success in securing water. And unlike, say, King Hezekiah 2,700 years ago, Blas had a more immediate thought, which is, if the Zionist idea is going to succeed, which is they're going to be in gathering the exiles, to use the Zionist formal phraseology, and be able to bring in not thousands or tens of thousands, but millions of Jews from around the world back to what the Zionists ideologically believe was their historic homeland, if they were able to do that, they would need to be able to figure out a way to increase the amount of water they had by a very significant amount. Excuse me. So Simcha Blas becomes, to some degree, over his career, the Leonardo da Vinci of water, and an inspiring, remarkable individual. And you'll see him woven throughout the early part of the book. Now, what happened is that in the 1930s, there was, for all kinds of reasons, which just time really doesn't let me get into right now, but I tell it in the book, the British Imperial Office makes a decision that it serves their interests to shut down basically all Jewish immigration to the land of Israel, to the Palestine Mandate. And they had realpolitik reasons for doing it. It ends up, not that this was their intent by any means, but it ends up causing the deaths of millions of Jews who were trapped in Europe who couldn't get visas out. But the excuse they gave was that there wasn't enough water in the area to survive the onslaught. And about that time, there was, under 1.5 million people, and the British brought in some economists who said that the area could thrive with up to 2 million total people in the area that today is Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. So keep that number in mind, 2 million, they said. And that would only be true some decades hence. So the Zionists now realize that this is the end, with no idea that the war is coming the way it's coming, no idea the Holocaust is coming, to be sure. But they begin thinking about the fact that if this is allowed to stand, it's the end of the idea of a Jewish homeland. Because if there's no immigrants coming in and there's just a relatively small number of existing Jewish people and families there, they're finished. So they go to the British with Simcha Blas's master plan, quickly put together, showing the British that there's actually enough water for millions of people. It requires creativity. It requires technology. It requires infrastructure. Well, the British don't relent. No visas are granted over and above the number in the white paper. The war ends. A few years later, Israel is declared an independent state. And the remarkable moment, though, is at that moment, is that they had the combined wisdom that they had developed during the war years of trying to show the British that there was plenty of water in the Middle East to be had. So come 1948, they're bankrupt. The state is just completely bankrupt. They're ingathering at this point, not the exiles, but they're ingathering survivors of the Holocaust. A few years later, all broken people, all bankrupt people. A few years later, they're ingathering then the accepting refugees from North Africa, from Iraq, from the Islamic world that are being expelled from those countries. The country doubles in size in a matter of a couple of years. It's the largest, fastest immigration here is in America. Imagine doubling the size of our country due to immigration, and think about the absorption problems you could have with that. And at the same time, defending all their borders against hostility from armies and terrorists wanting to attack them. It was a daunting challenge. Yet even so, and this is the key difference, Lisa, this is the key difference. Even so, they make the decision to prioritize water over other needs. Right. And that, if I can say, if you come away with anything from this evening, it's focus, it's vision. The Israelis are remarkable people. Many people here have experience with Israelis, either in the tech business here or having visited Israel. But I will say to you, what is not true about Israelis is they're not supermen and superwomen. They're no different than us. The difference from us is that they have focused on water from their first days till today, prioritized it, planned for it, budgeted for it, and decided that this is going to be a priority. Until we decide to do something comparable, until we start planning far in advance, we're going to have all kinds of problems here. And the lesson that I hope people have from the book is that it's a wake-up call that in a world that's increasingly short of water resources almost everywhere, the model of Israel, a country that has grown tenfold in population, 70-fold in GDP, at a time when, thanks to climate change, has lost 50% of its rainfall, still has such an adequacy of water, such an abundance, you call it a surplus, I'll call it an abundance, that it's able to give water to the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza every day, and to the Kingdom of Jordan every day, and even to have a multi-billion dollar agricultural export industry, and what frankly is agriculture, but value-added water. And the fact that the country could think about, that they could plan for a multi-generational agricultural industry speaks to a confidence that the water will be there when you need it. So all that put together gives us a model for an ever drier, ever more water constrained, ever more water scarce world. We see that there can be hope that we can be like Israel in this regard, and we will be fine if we do the types of things that they did, which I'm sure will be part of our conversation tonight.
Beautiful summary. Thank you so much. It also helps explain a key difference, actually, between California and Israel, and that is Israel takes a very absolutist approach to water, that it belongs to the people. And that explains, that beautiful history explains why, of how critically important it was that it belongs to the people. Here, as you know, we have a very complicated system of water rights that dates back to the Gold Rush, and then the development of California as an agricultural entity, and then the big state water project, and the Central Valley Project, and all the different aquifers which are now being drained. It's quite different in Israel. When my understanding is that when water falls from the sky, it hits the bucket. It's not yours. That may be your bucket, but the water that falls into it belongs to the land of Israel.
At least in principle. I mean, okay. I don't know that anybody's ever been indicted and prosecuted for scooping water out of a puddle in front of the rainfall. But you're right. I share in the book a fabulous interview I had. I interviewed about 220 people for the book. And not only did I fall in love with some of the historical characters that unfortunately I never had a chance to meet, but some of the people I interviewed have actually become friends. It was actually a very sweet experience. And one of them was a former water commissioner of Israel. And when I asked him to explain to me how absolutist this is, he gave the example that Lisa's referring to in the book. He says, if at the beginning of the rainy season you put a bucket on the roof of your house, at the end of the rainy season you still own your house, you still own your roof, you still own the bucket, but the water in that bucket is mine.
And people are willing to surrender these potential private ownership rights in exchange for a system that offers universal access.
And what makes it more remarkable is, indeed. But what makes it more remarkable is the fact that in the 1980s, in the Margaret Thatcher style privatization wave that went all over the whole world, Israel went through something similar. So they sold their national airline, all their national banks, their telecommunications. They sold off resources that the government owned, resource companies like potash down at the Dead Sea Works and so forth. But water, they made the decision to keep. Now, to give some context, because not everybody here knows exactly what I'm talking about, from almost the beginning, the decision was made to think of water in the way that is the highest, best use for the society as a whole. So unlike America, where we've got thousands, tens of thousands, millions of stakeholders in water, in Israel, there's basically one stakeholder. It's the government that makes the decision on behalf of the people. But the trade-off is that it's a vibrant democracy, and it's a free market system now. So the trade-off is that the government has to really do a good job looking out for the interests of the people. So the people are on top of this in a way that I would defy, even in this water-constrained time, even in California, I would bet that in an audience of this pretty significant size, plenty of people here don't know a lot about the ins and outs of water management or water governance and things like that. In Israel, what's remarkable is how widely known water stories are for everybody, and they live it.
So how did Israel restructure agriculture to identify this is a good use, this is not a good use? Maybe not cotton here, maybe not alfalfa here. Or was it driven purely by economics?
No, it was exactly of a piece with that, and it's that highest, best use mentality, where they went ahead and they said, look, in Israel's agriculture, there are some that are, none of the agriculture in Israel is government owned, but there are some socialist farms, kibbutzim they're called, where people jointly own the produce, and then there are some farms where people farm together and they share the machinery, and then there's some independent farms. So they have an interesting structure, but none of it is government owned. What they said in Israel is that any user of water, and this is a series of laws that goes back to early in the state's history, they said whatever use of water you want to have, feel free to apply for it. And to the extent that we can say yes, we will say yes. But if you have animals that cross a stream, don't forget, the water is not yours. It's ours. It's all of ours. So if you have animals that cross a stream and there could be some bad aspect of them crossing the stream, you need a license to have animals crossing the stream, even if it's on your property. If you drill a well on your own property, this is a sort of a concept shift we have to accept, right? Because in America, we think you own the land, you own what's under the land. They say, if you drill a well, feel free to drill a well, but get a permit for drilling the well to make sure it's done in a way that does not harm the aquifer. And we will decide for you how much water you can take out of that every year. Now, that may sound a little bit unfair, a little bit harsh, but I'm going to tell you something. I'm a New Yorker. I'm not a Californian, so just saying as an outside observer. If California had had a policy like that, you would not today be facing the dire situation you face now in the San Joaquin Valley and elsewhere, where aquifers, your underground treasure troves of water, are overpumped so severely that, first of all, the land above it is starting to sink. That's called subsidence. It's causing wildly important and expensive infrastructure shifts. Roads, bridges, power lines are going to have to be reformatted for this. But much, much more significantly, where is the stewardship for tomorrow? When you have a I'm a free marketeer. I'm a businessman, as you heard in the introduction. So I'm not some crazy socialist who thinks we should take over all the means of production, et cetera, et cetera. But I do want to make crystal clear that the effect of this completely, until a few months ago, unregulated approach to aquifers here has led to a situation where it is not inconceivable that in the lifetime of almost everybody here in the room, we will face a situation where some or many of our ancient aquifers will be pumped dry. These aquifers took thousands, tens of thousands of years to fill. And they were pumped out since 1950.
We had no idea what the drainage rate was, who was pumping, how much they were pumping. There's been no oversight.
No oversight. In Israel, yeah. No water is permitted to flow, even in a home, even in a business, since 1954.
Interesting.
Without it being sent through a meter. I'm going to ask some of these old timers, what was the reason for this? This was not the day of Google and big data. This was the era of wanting to, it would just be paper on a government shelf. Why would you do that? They said we had an intuitive sense way back then that you need to know what your resources are and how much of it you're using, and we figured we'd be able to have some use for it, and believe me, they have.
Talk about drip irrigation as well. I learned from reading your book, something like 75% of irrigated fields use drip irrigation. And that's something clearly we've been moving to in California, but a day late and a dollar short. And I wonder how that was implemented.
Yeah, by the way, I mentioned a few minutes ago when I was talking about this wonderful Leonardo da Vinci of water, Simcoe Blas, the guy who came up with the plan and the British. He ends up getting into a turf battle over how water should be administered and how this big infrastructure project called the National Water Carrier should be built. And in a huff, he resigns, certain that because he is so utterly crucial, the indispensable man theory, he is certain that he will quit and David Ben-Gurion and Levi Eshkol and all the other greats of the country will immediately realize how crazy they were. And of course, we'll call him back and say, we will change all of our ways to bring you back. Has anybody here ever been in a bureaucratic organization where that theory and strategy worked? Well, it didn't work for Blas either. So shocked, he ends up losing his job to his deputy. And even more shocked, he's sitting home licking his wounds for a couple of years. And all of a sudden, and it's a wonderful story that I'll spare for the readers of the book. And all of a sudden, he comes up basically with an old new idea, an idea that he had decades earlier, for drip irrigation. And the book Let There Be Water, obviously it's playing on the biblical Let There Be Light, but Let There Be Water could have been the name of Simcoe Blas's autobiography, because he is the man who made it happen. Let There Be Water, in the case of the drip irrigation, is that the way fields are primarily irrigated around the world to this day is by flood irrigation. And as the name implies, you plant your field, you have trenches perhaps, you flood the whole field. You wait for some of the water to hit the roots. Some does, an awful lot of it doesn't. Some of it just drips where the roots aren't. A lot of the water evaporates. And guess what? it doesn't do that much for the plants either. And then you got to flood the field again. Now, drip irrigation, again, as the name implies.
And it requires a significant capital investment, though, up front.
Drip irrigation? Does
the government help with that? I know.
To some degree, and that's a valuable thing. I mean, they have a smart tax policy and a smart agriculture policy in Israel about this. Which is something that, by the way, I argue strongly in the book, that there's no reason why California, I'll get to my punchline, California today is only about, the last study said that about 40% of our irrigated fields uses drip irrigation, which, by the way, is fantastic, because a few years ago it was far, far lower. But still, the reason we don't have it at 75, 85, 100% is because of the fact that we have an illogical water system where if you are adjacent to a waterway or you're adjacent to an aquifer, you have very little incentive necessarily to change your ways. What drip irrigation does is it drips about a drip here and a drip there of water where the roots are. Evaporation is close to zero. And the unbelievable Cracker Jack prize in the box surprise for Blas and for everybody else who was doing this was that for some reason, and we now understand plant chemistry why, but for some reason, at first they were shocked by it, the yield for drip irrigated crops is between 20% and 300 or 400% greater than it is for flood irrigated plants and crops. So you get this huge bonus in extra food, and you use about 50% as much water. It's a remarkable technology, and I will predict flat out, there's two or three technologies I'm sure we'll talk about now or tonight, I will flat out predict that in a water-constrained world, we have no choice. Everyone is going to be using this, and in fact, the fastest growing territory in the world with drip irrigation now is the country of India. It is just the runaway success story of Indian agriculture.
Interesting. Thank you. Another source of innovation was reclaimed water and reusing water. And what I learned in the book is something like 85% of the sewage that's collected in Israel is reclaimed and reused. And I mean, we also treat sewage, of course, but then we release it into the ocean or the lakes or the rivers. And Israel doesn't. Talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. That was actually, when I was talking about drip irrigation, I said there are two or three. That was the second. Right. And it's crucially important. Let me make clear to everyone how silly our approach is here. Most Western states, but most developing countries, this is not true of. This is not a universal practice. But most Western states treat all of their sewage. In the U.S., it's law, the Clean Water Act you've heard of. The Clean Water Act mandates that sewage be treated to a very high level of purity. And then what do we do with the water after we've cleaned the sewage that's now water that's so clean that you actually, if you had to, you could drink it. So I'm not suggesting you do, by the way. But does everyone know what sewage is, by the way? Sewage is the stuff that comes out of the shower, the sink in your kitchen, your dishwasher, your washing machine, your shower, your bathtub, and if I didn't say it already, your toilet. So it's some good stuff and some less good stuff. But the chemical and biological process that cleans it out makes it actually, can make it sort of return it to the way nature does it. You know, nature cleans our water. So what Israel decided in the 1950s, 1952 as a matter of fact, they decided that they are too water constrained to find themselves in a situation where they don't have extra water to spare. So what we do in America is we spend an enormous amount of money gathering our sewage, cleaning it to what's called tertiary level, three stages of cleaning. And then because we are so profligate, so silly with our water resources, that we then take it and we dump it, if we're in the California, we dump it into the Pacific. Now, what sense does that make? It's perfectly good, usable agricultural water. So Israel has a big head start on the rest of the world, and today, over 85% of the water, sewage water, is used for agriculture. In the United States, we're about 7%. But just to give you a sense of gap, even countries that should be doing it don't mostly do it. The second largest country is Spain at about 25%, and then it goes way down after that. So it's an essential piece, and I'll predict for you, just as I predicted that drip irrigation will be everywhere in a few years, I'm going to flat out predict to you that reused sewage water will be a commonly used element very soon. I hasten to add one other thing. There's another way that we're foolish and reckless, and that is there's all kinds of really valuable stuff in that sewage. There's precious metals, there's grease that could be reused for industry, and there's even a company in Israel that harvests what they call cellulosic material. also known as toilet paper. And they because that toilet paper is so enormous in volume that our landfills get filled with this stuff. And what they had this idea of is, this is crazy. We can clean this and reuse it for all the kinds of purposes. And they do. So we will be thinking differently about our sewage in a very short time, I predict.
I love that it's a precious resource and something to be valued. Let's address the third technology, and then we have some great questions here I'll get to. And that, of course, is desalination, which everyone has heard of. You call it manufactured water, which I love, because I think that really does reflect a lot of the cost involved. There are 5 large desalination plants on the Mediterranean, and also some plants inland, I understand, to clean up brackish water. There are a lot of issues here and debate over desalination in California because of the expense and that it might, you know, undercut incentives for conservation. But Israel's gone full steam ahead with this. And talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so one of the remarkable things about Israel is that even if every one of these technologies was not invented in Israel, though a lot of them are, and they had a very large role in this desalination revolution. And by the way, for those of us who are a certain generation here, one of the, oh my God, eureka moments of the research was to discover the role that Lyndon Johnson played in the desalination revolution. For those of you who have done research, you sit in archives and after a while you think your eyeballs are turning to sandpaper. You're just like, you look at your wristwatch and you think, wait a second, is it really only 14 seconds since I last looked at my wristwatch? Yeah. And then every so often you get a jolt of electricity and you think to yourself, oh my God, I have to do this the rest of my life. You know, it's like a drug. Well, that's what happened when I discovered that Lyndon Johnson was a junkie for desalination, and that he was the spur to some large degree to the success of the Israeli desalination industry. So what Israel does that's remarkable is they go all in. They don't wait until all the science is pure. They don't spend 20 years litigating whether or not a plant can't open in a certain place. That happened with Carlsbad, which drove the prices of the plant from $400 million to $1 billion and delayed opening of it. They say to themselves, we'll fix it later, we'll get going, and we're not gonna hold back. It's promising, it's important, we think it's a good idea, we'll go for it. It's a psychological change, it's a temperamental change, it's a national identity change, I don't know what it is, but in terms of water, it sure works. So,
forgive me, clarify Johnson's role in this then.
Oh, sure. Sure, I'd be glad to do that. So for sure. So Lyndon Johnson grew up in a farm. And he talked about, and I talk about this to some extent in the book, and he talked about how there's a world that's divided into basically two types of people, faucet turners and people who carry buckets and calloused hands looking skyward at the clouds. And he was in the second category. And he had this idea that if we could only desalt the sea. He never used the word desalination. If only we could desalt the sea, there would be water for everybody, there would be peace, there'd be prosperity. He thought about it, frankly, in messianic terms. And Israel had an embryonic desalination industry. It's a fascinating, crazy story about one oddball, and I don't mean to say anything disrespectful because they were all fascinating guys, but sort of one odd individual and then another odd individual. And maybe none of it made any sense, but Ben-Gurion had promised that he was going to make the desert bloom, and the only way he was going to do that was with water from the Mediterranean that he was going to desalt. And so they embarked on this idea, and I must tell you something. I read in translation Ben-Gurion's diaries, and you got to think that either the guy was crazy, a visionary, or a con man who was writing these diary entries figuring he'll con us, you know, 50 years later, because he was talking about alchemy. He was talking about turning something into something else at low cost in a way that had never been done. He was talking about turning lead into gold, and that's what he did. He turned worthless seawater into incredibly valuable, very healthy, pure to drink, desalinated water. It's really a remarkable thing. So Johnson encouraged them by giving them sort of dangling big checks in front of them that he'll write a check for this millions and that millions, and it set off the sort of this kind of this gold rush by the Israelis to come up with the big idea.
Interesting, it wasn't done here though, and we have concerns about use of energy, of course, for desalination. We have concerns about the cost of desalination. Does Israel have technologies that reduce energy consumption, or is the cost not an obstacle because it's so critically important?
So Israel actually has the world's largest, it's all in the same place, the world's largest desalination plant, the world's most energy efficient desalination plant, and the plant that produces water at the lowest cost per gallon. And what makes it even more remarkable is that it's a mile from the sea, because they decided that the seashore real estate was too valuable, so they built it a mile away, and then they did something called pipe jacking the pipes to the sea. And it's also the most environmentally friendly desalination plant in the world today. There are about 4,000 plants in the world, and all of these are in Israel. What will be the largest, most energy-efficient desalination plant in the Western Hemisphere will open next month in Carlsbad, California, designed by the same company that built this Israeli plant. So what's remarkable is about this is the idea that they understood all along that sooner or later they would have to convert over to desalination. They held off until the price came down, and the price came down a lot. They're still concerned about the energy load because there is a concern about that. But what isn't really a concern, I get asked this question a lot in audiences, what isn't really a concern is whether or not desalination makes the sea saltier. And the answer to that, some of you are thinking about that, there's a lot of sea out there. And the amount of brine that is added back into the sea isn't that much in context of that great big sea we have out there. But the Israelis do not, and this to understand this, the Israelis do not think of desalination as sort of the ultimate solution to their water problems. They think of it as a top-off. They think of desalination as a device for giving them that little bit extra so that they can live their lives comfortably and well. They're prepared to pay the price, which, by the way, is a lot cheaper than you would think. It's now 46 cents for 264 gallons, which is not bad. It's still more expensive than you'd want to use for agriculture, but it's still pretty cheap. And so, therefore, the idea that they're able to do this. Now, if I can just take a second, because it's a California story. The way and the reason that it's so cheap is that there was a fellow who came from California, went to Israel, came back and forth, and he came up with this new technology called reverse osmosis. So the policy had been freeze the water, then scoop the ice off, and then the second policy was boil the water and separate the condensed pure water from the salty water. Both of those were too energy consumptive. And then this fellow named Sidney Loeb, a fascinating schlemiel of a guy, in other words, schlemiel, a sad sack of a guy. He invented a business that is now a multi-hundred-billion-dollar industry. And for this, and he filed the patent, by the way. It's not like he forgot to file the patent. He filed the patent, and his lifetime earnings from it, because he never commercialized it, was $14,000. He's dead by the time I started researching the book, but I had a chance to sit and watch his widow flail around the living room. She recounted the economics to me. But I don't. I feel badly for it. But it was a technology that changed the world.
Yeah, I just love the role that innovation can play. That's a perfect example.
And I want to say that one more word about innovation. Mm-hmm. America is a larger country. We are a richer country. Mm-hmm. Israel's got some great institutions of higher learning, but America has many. We have among the best engineering schools in the entire world here. We have less than a mile from where we are. We have one of the most innovative companies in the world, probably among the two or three most innovative companies in the world, with the highest IQ per square inch there than imaginable. And think about this. It's just a question of the fact that we haven't yet said on our list of priorities that we need this. Think about this. People here probably were public affairs interested people. I'm guessing most people are following the presidential debates. Does anybody remember a single question about water policy in any debate? Not a chance. And I'll tell you something. I did research. I'm working on an op-ed. There's not yet a presidential candidate in either party that has issued a statement about water policy yet. Energy policy, sure. Other issues, sure. Water, not yet. And that's unacceptable. In a water-constrained world, I'd like to know where they stand on this. Privatization, eminent domain, technology use, tax policy in water, tax policy in agriculture, putting limits on pumping aquifers. I'd like to know all that.
sustainability. It's yep. often seen as a state issue or even a local issue here in California, but yep. it needs to be on the national agenda. We have a very pragmatic question here. We're coming out of a summer where a lot of people have been conserving, and the governor's insisted that we conserve. Question is, do Israelis have a limit of how much water they're allowed to use each month? Are there
So
are
what
there
Israel decided to do a few years ago was to completely change the paradigm, and it has worked brilliantly. What they told everybody is that they're changing the pricing structure in Israel. It was not popular. So people in Israel are not water-saving zealots, you know, where whatever the government says is fine. They're very cantankerous about this kind of stuff. So the government says we're raising the price for water, but we're going to do the following. And this should be the policy in America, too. It's a lockbox system. Everything you pay for your water and sewage goes to make our water and sewage yet better. Price, however, played a part. Market mechanisms play a part. And what ends up happening is they raise the price of water. All of the water fees are now used to make the water even more efficient, reduce leaks, focus on better technology. But now with the higher prices, people are told you can have, farmers too, told you can have all the water you want. So remember I said at the outset, you have to go to the government, you have to apply for a license to get more water from your well and all that. Today, uh-uh. You can get all the water you want, 100% of all the water you want, no limits, as long as you'll pay for it. That change led to a drop, spontaneous drop, of about 20% in water consumption that has stayed mm-hmm. firm for several years now.
What about those who can't afford that price?
You know, it's a modern society, and what they do is, in the same way that people can't afford food or rent, there are subsidies for the welfare system for people to do that. But what they do also is they incentivize you, they give you a step scale, so that the first X thousands of gallons that you use per every 2 months is slightly cheaper than real price, and everything above that is a little bit more. But the government also does something else for you. They help you. They help you by, in some of the municipalities, and this is expanding, there's a technology that's expanding throughout Israel, and I'm sure it will expand through everywhere in the world. They now attach in some of the localities, this is an Israeli innovation, they attach the equivalent of a cell phone to your meter, water meter. So not only does it save the municipality having meter readers going around house to house to read, you know, how much water since the last month, now these things send out, these little cell phones in essence, send out a message every about 4 hours. And just like, you ever been in a store with a credit card where you're making a purchase that's not like you, and all of a sudden the shopkeeper says you have to answer 3 questions on the phone, all right? It's called anomaly analysis. Well, it's the same thing with water now in Israel. If you historically on Thursdays between 12 and 8 use only X water, and suddenly you're using 3X water, the presumption is that you've got a problem. Somebody notifies you, oh, no, I'm filling my boiler. No, I'm filling my swimming pool. Okay, fine. But no, I'm doing nothing differently.
It's leak detection.
It is. Then. I'm doing nothing differently. Well, yeah. If you're doing nothing differently, I got news for you, baby.
Yeah.
You got a leak. We're sending a crew out right now.
Oh, wow. Wow. Beautiful. Thank you. But on pricing, can agriculture ever compete with municipalities? I mean, you have to believe if it goes to the higher value, you know, washing silicon chips or other uses will always trump raising asparagus or
so what
corn.
Israel does exactly you're totally exactly right, it will always. So what Israel does is it uses its marginal water for agriculture. So remember we talked about all that great sewage that we now love, instead of it being a nuisance, now it's valuable. So Israel built a parallel infrastructure. Some of you have heard of an organization called JNF here in the United States. JNF helped construct, with in partnership with Israeli farmers, hundreds of reservoirs to hold treated sewage water. The government of Israel, through the Water Authority, built out a parallel water infrastructure that takes the water from the sewage treatment plants to the fields and then stores it in these reservoirs, and then they're used when the farmers need them. The farmers pay for that sewage water, but they pay a fraction of what they would pay for fresh water. So they're given an incentive. You want more fresh water? All you want. But why would you want it? And also, one other thing that Israel has mastered, in the same way that we drill very deep for oil and gas, Israel has mastered deep drilling for water. And that mastery means that in the desert, where there's lots of marginally good water called brackish water, which is water from antiquity and from prehistoric times, from the times of the dinosaurs, And there's these pockets, these massive pockets of fresh water. But over the years, minerals and salts have infiltrated into the water. So they take that water out. Sometimes it's usable as is from the desert for desert agriculture. And sometimes they dilute it slightly. So Israel's found a way to make maximum use of all their water resources so that farmers actually don't have to use a lot of fresh water.
Okay, interesting. A related question about reuse and recycling and capturing water. The question is, shouldn't we be separating gutter rainwater and reuse it rather than throwing it into the sewage?
Israel also has a practice of saving some of their rainwater. However, at some point you have to think about economics and you have to think about what's the best way to save your water. So I would say, I don't know who asked that question, but I'm trying to make eye contact with everybody at the same time. So what I would say to that questioner is it's essential to think about what's the most cost-effective way of doing that. And I want to give an example. Before you go ahead and build a whole infrastructure to capture rain, depending upon where you are, if you're in Northern California and you have a lot of rain, that's a wonderful way to do it. But if you're in other locales which have irregular rain, or some seasons with a lot of rain and some seasons with not a lot of rain, then you're building out an expensive infrastructure, Lisa, that you may never use. So therefore, what you want to do is you want to think, where's the smart, good water? So what Israel decided was, after building out that rain capture system, and they have a system for that, and they use it, they said, before we expand it, and we're prepared to expand it, because you lose millions and millions of gallons in every rainfall, they said, before we do that, we're going to expand our sewage treatment, because it's sewage that's predictable. Whether it's the 3rd of January or the 3rd of June, you more or less, you know, we shower, most of us, every day, et cetera. Okay, so it's more or less the same amount of water coming out of our homes every day, right? So therefore, you can be predictable about it, and you can build your infrastructure for it. And I think that that's actually a clever idea, so that when you need to go to rain capture, I think that's a time for that. And also, don't think, you know, we think of rain as pure water. It is while it's falling from the sky. The second it hits the ground, it picks
it's
up.
Contaminated.
Oh, it's so contaminated. Yeah. All the stuff, the exhaust from buses and cars and trucks, it picks up all that stuff. It rolls along and it picks up more and more contaminants. It's a very dastardly thing to clean.
So that's really not a major future source.
It could be. Look, you know, I just to make myself really ready for this trip, I watched Mad Max on the flight out here. I don't know how many of you ever saw that movie, but you know, it's like an apocalyptic world. apocalyptic world, you know, where they warn people don't get too used to water; it becomes addictive. You know, so I don't think we're there. But if we ever got to that situation, then it's all hands on deck. You know, then for sure you'd want to do that.
Another question or two about California, and then I'd love to move on to regional and global issues. My understanding is that Governor Brown and Netanyahu have spoken, and that there's an agreement and a cooperative agreement to partner with smarter use of water. Talk about what that agreement says, and then how do we build on that agreement to create something of substance that's not just a piece of paper?
Yeah, so in March of 2014, when the drought, if you recall, there was a drought emergency declared, I think in either January or February of that year. And in March of 2014, Prime Minister Netanyahu came to California, actually to Mountain View. It was signed in Mountain View.
I
just realized that. Wow, that's pretty exciting. Because we're in Mountain View, or Palo Alto, I guess, right?
Close.
Isn't it the same thing? It's
one block
apart. Okay, so good. Mm-hmm. So not that anybody here would walk, but you could walk to there from here. Right. I'm a Manhattanite, you know, most
you
of my
everywhere.
Life. I keep looking for the sidewalks. Where are the sidewalks? You know. So Prime Minister Netanyahu came here, and they signed a memorandum of understanding. And what was so fascinating about the document was that it was really more a structure for cooperation than an explicit statement of this is what we're going to do for you. And what the structure is that in three levels, government, business, and academia, there's a sharing of ideas and a partnering with ideas with the idea that there's plenty of genius here in California, but that Israel, just for whatever reason, has a long head start on these issues. And so the plan is, and supposedly now dozens of cooperative agreements have been entered into between the two parties, which is great for the economy of California, and it's going to be great for the water future of California,
too. What's that mean practically, a cooperative agreement?
Well, for example, in Los Angeles, there's an aquifer that's highly polluted. So Israel has water remediation techniques that work very well. So they partnered. There was a clause in the agreement that said that this is not just a state plan that's also not imposed upon cities and municipalities, but encouraged for them to partner. And so Los Angeles has done so. And so the idea of this is, as an example, is to partner on ways that will help California. Some of this is more high-level research, academic-to-academic stuff. That's more futuristic stuff.
Terrific. For those of us who haven't had a chance to travel there recently, what is the state of the health of some of the bodies of water that we know and love historically? The Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee.
You know what's interesting is that this is a virtuous circle. The idea of having smart water policy makes everything better. It makes Israel's relationship, as bad as it is with the Palestinians, it makes it better. As bad as the environment may be in a water-constrained universe, it makes it better. Rivers are healthier when they have more flow. Lakes are healthier when they're at a sort of a naturally high level. Not overflow, but a naturally high level. Aquifers do very well when they're in a balance of just a few inches, actually. Not too high, not too low, not pumped out, kept in some type of stable level. And so Israel's water abundance has allowed it to safeguard the Sea of Galilee in a way that's really remarkable, to safeguard the aquifers that Israel, once upon a time, was the lifeblood of the country, but now, frankly, has dropped in value because of these other sources of water. But still, it's a precious and important part of the water mix. But now, rather than pumping it lower and lower if there's a year or two or five of drought, they are able to understand what is the environmentally perfect level for the aquifers, what is the environmentally perfect level for the Sea of Galilee, and to leave it at a certain level that it is. And then
How about the lower Jordan River?
Yeah, the lower Jordan River, I talk about that in the book a little bit. The lower Jordan River is still something that's a problem. And I don't want to suggest that by any means that everything is perfect in Israel. In fact, I point out river work that needs to still be done in several places. The lower Jordan, though, there is some hope for the lower Jordan, though, by using some of these same techniques that have worked very well. By the way, for those of you who have never been to Israel and think of the Jordan River from sort of spirituals that we grew up with hearing or singing on camp buses or whatever, let me just say that if you're in reasonably good health, with a running jump, you can get over the Jordan River in some of the places. That's how wide the mighty Jordan River is.
And you know, was it Kissinger who said it had more reputation than it did water?
Yes,
I love
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And I think it was Senator Henry Jackson said something about that that the river was an act of public relations genius.
Yeah, and it's so tragic, though,
but historically. But I will say that one of the ways that it's going to get better is there's a plan afoot now to take some water from some of the other towns and divert it from the sewage water that's being treated and divert it from being used for agriculture and now to use it for the health of the Jordan River, so to increase the flow.
Great. Let's talk about Israel's neighbors. I understand there's an agreement with Jordan. There was an agreement with Iran. And certainly it has some other neighbors that are highly water-stressed. And then the Palestinians. There's cooperation there.
Yeah.
Elaborate on that, if you could.
Yeah, well, the Palestinian story is actually one that will shock almost everybody who's a daily reader of the newspapers. Because if you read the newspapers every day, you would think that all there is bad news, without having to go be more graphic. All there is bad news between Israelis and Palestinians. And I'll circle back to that in a moment. The Iran piece is one of those, again, those like Lyndon Johnson, one of those, oh my God, I can't believe it moments. What happened was with that is I was interviewing the guy who came up with the idea of drilling deep for water in the Negev desert. He's a now fairly old man, late 80s. He had recently suffered a stroke, and I was interviewing him at a cafe in Jerusalem. I interviewed, I think I mentioned, over 200 people for the book, about 220 people for the book, and he was just one of these guys I just totally fell in love with again. And he's talking about how he came up with this idea and how everyone thought he was insane and how he drilled deep one place and came up dry, and people laughed at him, and he was a professor, and people were saying he has no right being a teacher anymore, and on and on like this. And then finally, of course, he discovered water and lots of water under the desert. Now it's a model for the entire region to those who want to make use of it. And then I asked him a question in sequence. He says, well, I don't know, because I was in Iran then. So I thought to myself, what do you mean you were in Iran then? He says, yeah. He says, you know, I was sort of like the head of the Iranian water program then. So like this gentleman who was just, I thought was going to get whiplash a second ago. Yeah, that was my reaction. So like, what? Are you kidding me? Really? So I come home and I was writing an op-ed for the New York Times on a completely unrelated topic, but about water. And then I threw in a sentence or a paragraph about Israel's supervision of the Iranian water sector. And, you know, when you write for, like you do, for big media, you know, you get a lot of people read you and notice. And all of a sudden, the day of and the day after and the weeks after that op-ed appeared, I got an uncountably large number of calls and emails from people saying, what more can you tell me about this Iran thing? So I was already thinking of writing the book. I was already at work on the book. And I mean, I may not be the world's greatest reporter, but I thought to myself all of a sudden, geez, this is a great moment. I got a story people want to hear. So I called up this fellow who I interviewed at the coffee shop in Jerusalem. And I said, can you please tell me the name of everybody else who was with you in Iran who's still alive? Because they're all in their late 80s, early 90s now. And he gave me a list of people, and they are all, that everyone I spoke to was so sharp, had such great memories. And the story, I'll tell it briefly because I tell it in some length in the book. The story is quite remarkably that inside, from 1962 to 1979 when the revolution hit, Israel functionally ran the water sector for Iran for irrigation, for sewage treatment, for fresh water supply for cities and so forth. They built many desalination plants inside of Iran. It was really the golden age of water for Iran. And the tragic story is, and I will try not to editorialize, but the tragic story is that since 79, they have chosen to not spend money on their national water infrastructure to a large degree. They've spent money on other plans, and this is where I won't editorialize, but you can imagine where I want to go. And the water system there has deteriorated to the point that now Iran's water system is considered among the three or four worst water systems in the world. Mm-hmm. So it just says, I mean, I'm not suggesting that Iran's going to any day soon call the Israelis back in and be partners with them, but it's just such a sad thing that in this case, Israel used this as an outreach to Absolutely. The world beyond the world that they were talking to. Now, Israel has used water as, I use the phrase hydro-diplomacy in the book. Israel has used water as a way of reaching out to countries that would have no diplomatic relations with them. China's relationship with Israel, which I talk about in some detail in the book, was born through water. China has so many water problems that China finally decided to overcome its antipathy to Israel and the idea of having diplomatic relations with Israel. They decided to finally have a deal with Israel that brought water expert to China, and that led to diplomatic relations. And they do the same with any country that they can do it with, including Arab states, with Egypt for
so
sure.
Turkey is diverting the Tigris and the Euphrates. Egypt is very inefficient in its water use.
Egypt, very much so.
I know Sudan is worried about Ethiopia. So
the whole region is a mess. The whole region. Uh-huh. Turkey has pumped out its aquifers as badly as one can do. The entire Anatolian aquifer system is now pumped almost dry. They are now diverting the Tigris and Euphrates River, which is causing crisis in Syria and in Iraq. Yemen's capital city Sana'a is, they say, no more than 2 to 3 years away from being dry. Mm-hmm. So 4 million people will have to relocate. So the whole region is a mess, and they have so much that they could learn from the Israel example. But I want to tell you what is working. Mm-hmm. And this is what I want to say, not that we should always be optimistic about everything, but in this case, there's some good news, and we shouldn't ignore the good news. And I tell the story in the book. The Palestinians have as their backstop Israel's water supply. Israel encourages the development of high-quality water systems for the Palestinians, and the Palestinians have the potential of funding from the European states that are prepared to give them large amounts of money for funding their water systems. And so what you have now is a situation where on the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority there gets 55% of its water from Israeli water supplies. So the same water that you would drink in Tel Aviv, which is as healthy as the water you would drink in New York City or other major metropolitan centers, is the same water you drink in Tel Aviv is the same water you get in Ramallah. 55% of that water comes from Israeli supplies. Now, I don't want to pretend that everything is perfect in water between the parties. The Palestinians complain about water pressure, they complain about supply, they complain about volume. But Israel had obligations under the Oslo Agreement. They fulfill that, and they give more than they are obligated to do. They have obligations to Jordan under the treaty with Jordan. They give that plus more. And they do that not just because they're nice guys. They do that because they think it's smart to have neighbors who have good economies, who have enough water. But what their neighbors aren't doing enough of, in the Israeli view, is using these technologies, using smart use of conservation, using drip irrigation widely as they should, using treated sewage as much as they should. And so these are things that still are works in progress. But what Israel does do is they have training programs inside of Israel where they bring Palestinian engineers to Israel, never with newspaper people there, never with headlines. And my book has many photographs with captions, and I have a fantastic photograph, a whole roll of photographs, of one of the classes where the Israeli teachers, water professionals, teach Palestinian water engineers and water people. And
so
I have a graduation
ceremony. Both Gaza and the West Bank?
Well, not Gaza since Hamas took over because they don't permit people out. But until then, yes.
Right.
But the West Bank, yes, now, currently. Mm-hmm. And Gaza previously, yes. Mm-hmm. And so the Israelis were in a situation where they produced this. Now, that's that's sort of the people-to-people part of it. But the better part of this is that even at times when there's no conversation between the parties, there's a back-channel conversation because Israel and the Palestinians have to cooperate on water. So I make the argument that, yeah, sure, we can see all the bad, to not make a joke, we can see the glass of water half full. But I think there's a way to say that water could actually be a pathway to peace or a template for the way they could talk to each other. If in Oslo there were five final status issues, and if I recall them correctly, it's Jerusalem, refugees, borders, security, and the fifth one was water. The passage of time and the advancement of Israeli technology has made that part of the five problems much more solvable than it was previously. And I think that is really good news. And I think it's good news that it opens the door for the parties to speak when they can, as much as they can.
Absolutely. Thank you. And forgive me, the status of water in Gaza now. How are they doing?
Terribly. Yeah. Terribly, horribly. And I tell you, it makes me so sad and at the same time so angry. Because here's a phrase I'd like you to try to remember if you can. Water problems are a proxy for bad governance. That's true everywhere in the world. It's true in California also. When you've got a water problem, it means you've got bad governance because you shouldn't have water problems in this day and age. The technology is there to fix it before it becomes a problem. You need about a 10-year head start, and if the government was focused on it, it wouldn't be a problem. So water problems are a proxy for bad governance. In Gaza, Lisa, in Gaza, you've got bad governance married to crazy ideology. So the people of Gaza have a highly polluted aquifer that they are sitting on top of. I talk about at length in the book why that's the case. It will make you cry. It will make you crazy. It makes me crazy. Anybody who cares, forgetting about the goodwill of Israel, anybody who cares about the goodwill of people anywhere, this would make you crazy. Hamas refuses to do what it has to do, which is basically to stop using the cement and the metal they get that they can build out these infrastructure facilities for water, to agree not to use it, to build tunnels into Israel so to attack Israel. But even that doesn't have to be done. The Israelis are prepared to divert water from their desalination plants on the Mediterranean and ship it into Gaza in exchange for a fee. They're prepared to take the sewage that right now leaches into the aquifer in Gaza. It's not get treated. Israel's prepared to buy for cash money the sewage of Gaza so they can treat it, purify it, and use it in the Western Negev, and they cannot get Hamas to agree. And this will drive you crazy when you think about the fact that they are prepared to let their own people suffer and have a dire water future.
Yeah, you wonder what it'll take.
Oh, my God. And it's not like there's a question mark here. Mm-hmm. We are talking about 5 years, 6 years at the most, 7 years before the aquifer is totally, completely, environmentally ruined. And then they're going to have to figure out another way to get water. And I'll tell you something else that drives me nuts. you know, there's a rivalry between Hamas and Fatah. Fatah is the West Bank and the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas is the Islamic Brotherhood and the Muslim Brotherhood, Palestinian division. And what gets me crazy is that the Palestinian Authority is prepared to let this continue to fester because their attitude is they win either way. It shows the people of Gaza what bad governors the Hamas people are. And when things blow up, it gives them a club with which to try to hit Israel with. And it makes me crazy. Not because Israel will be blamed, because it shouldn't be blamed or whatever. Mm-hmm. It makes me crazy because people's lives are being played with by governors and the government that is doing it for their own selfish mm-hmm. interests and not looking out for the well-being of their people.
Thank you. So we've reached the point of the last question, and I encourage people to come up and speak with Seth afterwards, and I'm happy to talk as well. The book does end on an optimistic note, and that is, the technology is there. With good governance, we can get this right. And there's a pathway forward. The old paradigm was that we could add capacity. We could add more pipes. We could add more reservoirs. And this is relevant to California as well. We could drill more. We could pump more. What you're describing is a new paradigm. And describe the future of your dreams with California, Israel as an example, in a world where there are solutions.
Well, I'd like to, if I can, since this is the last question, since the first question I thanked the Ashman JCC and the Commonwealth Club, I'd like to, first of all, thank this audience. It's been a really fun interacting with you all. The room has been a little bit warm. I don't know about you, if it's as warm for you as it is for me. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. and the audience's rapt attention has really been lovely. And I really, really, Lisa, I want to thank you. Wonderful, you clearly prepared so elegantly and wonderfully for this with such wonderful questions, and I'm very touched by it all. Thank you. Listen, this does not have to end badly. The reason why I'm optimistic, and I'm optimistic generally in life, the reason why this does not have to end badly is because we see a model that works. It's not fanciful. It's not like, oh my God, there's a meteor coming towards Earth, and maybe if we blow it up at this angle or that angle, we can save the Earth like one of those movies. No. This is, we have population growth, we have rising affluence, we have less rainfall, we have polluted resources. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? It's Israel. They solve their problems. If they solve their problems with all their other problems, with all their budget issues, goodness knows, why can't we? And we can, and we will, if only we will focus in time. So I'm optimistic because of the fact that if we are prepared, and I think we can be, we have big, important issues, and we've got community leaders here who care about these issues. If we get the word out and we unleash our technological genius and our business genius, we're going to be just fine. Maybe by a hair's breadth, maybe it'll be like that great movie that we think that we shouldn't be watching here, but we will be fine. But we got to get going, and we got to get going soon. And that's my word, and that's why I'm optimistic.
So thank you so much. Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Ashman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Seth M. Siegel, author of Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World, Lisa Krieger, science, medicine, and water reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And now, this meeting is adjourned.